Jamie said, still eyeing the man cautiously. The giant smiled and put a calloused thumb and forefinger an inch apart.
Ah, purr.
A very little purr, as they shortly discovered. The man had roughly a dozen words of French, just about enough to introduce himself as one Mikhail Chomodorov, his wife Iva, and his daughter Karina.
Rushki,
Chomodorov said, slapping a hand across his beefy chest.
Russians?
Roger stared at them, flabbergasted, though Jamie seemed fascinated.
I've never met a Russian before, he said. What in Christ's name are they doing here, though?
With some difficulty, this question was conveyed to Mr. Chomodorov, who beamed and flung a massive arm out, pointing toward the wharf.
Les cochons, he said, pour le Monsieur Wiley.
He looked expectantly at Jamie.
Monsieur Wiley?
Given the eye-watering aroma rising off all three of the Russians, the mention of pigs came as no great surprise. The connection between Russian swineherds and Philip Wiley was somewhat less obvious. Before the question could be gone into, though, there was a loud thump outside and a grinding noise, as though some large wooden object had struck the dock. This was succeeded immediately by a piercing chorus of bellows and squeals, mostly porcine, but some of them human and female. Chomodorov moved with amazing speed for his size, though Jamie and Roger were on his heels as he shot through the door of the shed. Roger had barely time to see that there were two boats now tied up at the wharf, the Russian's small bark and a smaller open boat. Several men, bristling with knives and pistols, were swarming out of the smaller boat onto the dock. Seeing this, Jamie dived to one side, disappearing out of sight round the edge of a smaller shed. Roger grabbed his pistol, but hesitated, not sure whether to fire or run. Hesitated a moment too long. A musket jammed up under his ribs, knocking out his breath, and hands snatched at his belt, taking pistols and dirk.
"Don't move, mate," the man holding the musket said. "Twitch and I'll blow your liver out through your backbone."
He spoke with no particular animus, but sufficient sincerity that Roger wasn't inclined to test it. He stood still, hands half-raised, watching. Chomodorov had waded into the invaders without hesitation, laying about him with hands like hams. One man was in the water, evidently having been knocked off the wharf, and the Russian had another in his grip, throttling him with brutal efficiency. He ignored all shouts, threats and blows, his concentration fixed on the man he was killing. Screams rent the air. Iva and Karina had rushed toward their boat, where two of the invaders had appeared on deck, each clutching a slightly smaller version of Karina. One of the men pointed a pistol at the Russian woman. He appeared to pull the trigger. Roger saw a spark and a small puff of smoke, but the gun failed to fire. The women didn't hesitate, but charged him, shrieking. Panicking, he dropped the gun and the girl he was holding and jumped into the water. A sickening thud wrenched Roger's attention from this byplay. One of the men, a short, squat figure, had clubbed Chomodorov over the head with the butt of a gun. The Russian blinked, nodded, and his grip on his victim loosened slightly. His assailant grimaced, took a tighter hold on the gun, and smashed him again. The Russian's eyes rolled up into his head, and he dropped to the dock, shaking the boards with the impact. Roger had been looking from man to man, searching urgently amid the melee for Stephen Bonnet. Look as he might, though, there was no trace of the Gloriana's erstwhile captain. What was wrong? Bonnet was no coward, and he was a natural fighter. It wasn't thinkable that he would send men in and hang back himself. Roger looked again, counting heads, trying to keep track of men. But the conclusion became stronger as the chaos quickly died down. Stephen Bonnet wasn't there. Roger hadn't time to decide whether he was disappointed or relieved by this discovery. The man who had clubbed Chomodorov turned toward him at this point, and he recognized David Anstruther, the sheriff of Orange County. Anstruther recognized him too. He saw the man's eyes narrow, but didn't seem surprised to see him. The fight, such as it was wrapping up quickly. The four Russian women had all been rounded up and pushed into the largest shed amid much screaming and shouting of curses, and the fallen Chemodarov was dragged in as well, leaving a disquieting smear of blood along the boards in his wake. At this point, a pair of well-kept hands appeared on the edge of the dock, and a tall, elegantly lean man pulled himself up from the boat. Roger had no difficulty in recognising Mr. Lillywhite, one of the Orange County magistrates, even without his wig and bottle-green coat. Lillywhite had dressed for the occasion in plain black broadcloth, though his linen was as fine as ever, and he had a gentleman's sword at his side. He made his way across the dock in no great hurry, observing the disposition of matters as he went. Roger saw his mouth tighten fastidiously at the sight of the trail of blood. Lillywhite gestured to the man holding Roger, and at last the bruising pressure of the gun muzzle eased, allowing him to draw a deep breath.
"Mr. Mackenzie, is it not?" Lillywhite asked pleasantly. "And where is Mr. Fraser?"
He'd been expecting that question, and had time to contemplate the answer.
"In Wilmington," he said, matching Lillywhite's pleasant tone. "You're rather far afield yourself, are you not, sir?"
Lillywhite's nostrils pinched momentarily as though smelling something bad, which he certainly was, though Roger doubted the reek of pigs was causing his disedification.
"Do not trifle with me, sir," the magistrate said curtly.
"Wouldn't dream of it,"
Roger assured him, keeping an eye on the fellow with the musket, who seemed disposed to resume jabbing.
"Though if we're asking that sort of question, where's Stephen Bonnet?"
Lillywhite gave a brief laugh, a sort of wintry amusement coming into his pale grey eyes.
"In Wilmington."
Anstruther appeared at the magistrate's elbow, squat and sweaty. He gave Roger a nod and an ugly grin.
"Mackenzie, nice to see you again. Where's your father-in-law? And more important, where's the whiskey?"
Lillywhite frowned at the sheriff.
"You haven't found it? Have you searched the sheds?"
"Aye, we looked. Nothing there but bits of rubbish."
He rocked up onto his toes, menacing.
"So, Mackenzie, where'd you hide it?"
"I haven't hidden anything," Roger replied equably. "There isn't any whiskey."
He was beginning to relax a little. Wherever Stephen Bonnet was, he wasn't here. He didn't expect them to be pleased at discovering that the whiskey was a ruse, but... The sheriff hit him in the pit of the stomach. He doubled up. His vision went dark, and he struggled vainly to breathe, fighting a flash of panic as he relived his hanging, the black, the lack of air. Bright floating spots appeared at the edges of his vision, and he drew breath, gasping. He was sitting on the dock, legs splayed out before him, the sheriff clutching a handful of his hair.
"Try again," Anstruther advised him, shaking him roughly by the hair.
The pain was irritating rather than discomforting, and he swiped a fist at the sheriff, catching him a solid blow on the thigh. The man yelped and let go, hopping backward.
"Did you look on the other boat?"
Lillywhite demanded, ignoring the sheriff's discomfort. Anstruther glowered at Roger, rubbing his thigh, but shook his head in answer.
"Nothing there but pigs and girls. And where in fuck's name did they come from?" he demanded.
"Russia!"
Roger coughed, clenched his teeth against the resulting burst of pain, and got slowly to his feet, holding an arm across his middle to keep his guts from spilling out. The sheriff doubled a fist in anticipation, but Lillywhite made a quelling gesture toward him. He looked incredulously at Roger.
"Russia? What have they to do with this business?"
"Nothing, so far as I knew. They arrived soon after I did."
The magistrate grunted, looking displeased. He frowned for a moment, thinking, then decided to try another tack.
"Fraser had an arrangement with Milford Lyon. I have now assumed Mr. Lyon's part of the agreement. It is altogether proper for you to deliver the whisky to me," he said, attempting to infuse a note of businesslike politeness into his voice.
"Mr. Fraser has made other arrangements," Roger said with equal politeness. "He sent me to say as much to Mr. Lyon."
That seemed to take Lillywhite aback. He pursed his lips and worked them in and out, staring hard at Roger as though to estimate his truthfulness. Roger stared blandly back, hoping that Jamie wouldn't reappear inopportunely and put paid to his story.
"How did you get here?" Lilywhite demanded abruptly. "If you did not travel on that boat."
"I came overland from Edenton."
Blessing Duff for the information, he waved casually over his shoulder.
"There's a shell road back there."
The two of them stared at him, but he stared back undaunted.
"Something smells fishy and it isn't the marsh."
Anstruther sniffed loudly in illustration, then coughed and snorted.
"Phew! What a stink!"
Lilywhite disregarded this, but went on looking at Roger with a narrowed eye.
"I think perhaps I must inconvenience you for a little longer, Mr. Mackenzie," he said, and turned to the sheriff. "Put him in with the Russians, if that's what they are."
Anstruther accepted this commission with alacrity, prodding Roger in the buttocks with the muzzle of his musket as he forced him toward the shed where the Russians were imprisoned. Roger gritted his teeth and ignored it, wondering how high the sheriff might bounce if picked up and slammed down on the boards of the dock. The Russians were all clustered in the corner of the shed, the women tending solicitously to their wounded husband and father, but they all looked up at Roger's entrance, with a babble of incomprehensible gestures and questions. He gave them as much of a smile as he could manage, and waved them back, pressing his ear to the wall of the shed in order to hear what Lilywhite and company were up to now. He had hoped they would simply accept his story and depart, and they might still do that once they satisfied themselves that there really was no whiskey hidden anywhere near the landing. Another possibility had occurred to him, though, one that was making him increasingly uneasy. It was clear enough from the behaviour of the men that they had intended to take the whiskey by force, if there had been any. And the way Lilywhite had held back, concealing himself. It wouldn't do, obviously, for a county magistrate to be revealed as having connections with smugglers and pirates. As it was, since there was no whiskey, Roger could report no actual wrongdoing on Lilywhite's part. It was illegal to deal in contraband, of course, but such arrangements were so common on the coast that the mere rumour of it wasn't likely to damage Lilywhite's reputation in his own inland county. On the other hand, Roger was alone. Or Lilywhite thought he was. There was clearly some connection between Lilywhite and Stephen Bonnet, and if Roger and Jamie Fraser began to ask questions, chances were good that it would come to light. Was whatever Lilywhite was engaged in sufficiently dangerous that he might think it worth killing Roger to prevent his talking? He had the uneasy feeling that Lilywhite and Anstruther might well come to that conclusion. They could simply take him into the marsh, kill him, and sink his body, then return to their companions, announcing that he had gone back to Edenton. Even if someone eventually traced the members of Lilywhite's gang, and if they could be persuaded to talk, both matters of low probability, nothing could be proved. There was a lot of thumping and banging outside, gradually succeeded by more distant calling, as the sheds were researched, and the search then spread to the nearby marsh. It occurred to Roger that Lilywhite and Anstruther might well have intended to kill him and Jamie after taking the whiskey. In which case, there was still less to prevent them doing it now. They would be already prepared for it. As for the Russians, would they harm them? He hoped not, but there was no telling. A light pattering rang on the tin roof of the shed. It was beginning to rain. Fine. If their powder got wet, they wouldn't shoot him. They'd have to cut his throat. He went from hoping that Jamie wouldn't show up too soon to hoping fervently that he wouldn't show up too late. As to what he might do, if and when he did show up. The swords. Were the swords still where they had left them, in the corner of the shed? The rain had grown too loud for him to hear anything outside, anyway. He abandoned his listening post and went to look. The Russians all looked up at him with mingled expressions of wariness and concern. He smiled and nodded, making little shooing gestures to get them out of the way. Yes, the swords were still there. That was something, and he felt a small surge of hope. Chermadarov was still conscious. He said something in a slurred voice, and Karina got up at once and came to stand by Roger. She patted him gently on the arm, then took one of the swords from him. She drew it from its scabbard with a ringing whoosh that made them all jump, then laugh nervously. She wrapped her hands round the hilt and held it over her shoulder like a baseball bat. She marched over to the door and took up her station beside it, scowling fiercely.
"Great,"
Roger said, and gave her a broad smile of approval.
"Anyone pokes his head in, take it off, aye."
He made a chopping motion with the side of his hand, and the Russians all made loud growling sounds of enthusiastic support. One of the younger girls reached for the other sword, but he smiled and indicated that he would keep it, thanks anyway. To his surprise, she shook her head, saying something in Russian. He raised his eyebrows and shook his head helplessly. She tugged on his arm and made him come with her back toward the corner. They had been busy during the brief period of their captivity. They had moved aside the rubbish, made a comfortable pallet for the injured man, and uncovered the large trapdoor installed in the floor, meant to be used by boats coming under the wharf at low tide, so that cargo could be handed directly up into the shed rather than unloaded onto the dock. The tide was going out now. It was a drop of more than 6 feet to the water's dark surface. He stripped to his breeks and hung by his hands from the edge of the trapdoor before dropping in feet first, not wanting to risk a dive into what might be dangerous shallows. The water was higher than his head, though. He sank in a shower of silver bubbles, then his feet touched the sandy bottom, and he launched himself upward, breaking the surface with a whoosh of air. He waved reassuringly at the circle of Russian faces peering down at him through the trapdoor, then struck out for the far end of the wharf. Lilywhite turned away, his hand nervously caressing the hilt of his sword. From his perch on the roof of the shed, Jamie assessed the magistrate's way of moving and the manner in which he fondled the weapon. A long reach and a good bearing. Quick, too, if a little jerky. To wear a sword under these circumstances suggested both a habit of familiarity with the weapon and a fondness for it. He couldn't see Anstruther, who had pressed himself back against the wall of the shed, under the overhang of the roof, but he was less concerned with the sheriff. A brawler, that one, and short in the arm.
"I say we kill them all. Only way to be safe."
There was a grunt of dubious assent from Lilywhite.
"That may be, but the men. We do not wish to put our fate in the hands of witnesses who may talk. We could have dealt with Fraser and Mackenzie safely out of sight, but so many. Perhaps we may leave these Russians. They are foreigners and seem not to speak any English."
"Aye, and how did they come here, I'd like to know? I'll warrant they wasn't caught up in a waterspout and set down here by accident. Someone knows about them. Someone will come looking for them. And whoever that someone is, he's got some means to talk to them, I'll be bound. They've seen too much already, and if you mean to go on using this place..."
The rain was still light, but coming down steadily. Jamie turned his head to wipe the moisture out of his eyes against his shoulder. He was lying flat, arms and legs outspread like a frog's, to keep from sliding down the pitch of the tin roof. He didn't dare to move, just yet. The rain was whispering out on the sound, though, puckering the water like drawn silk, and making a faint ringing noise on the metal around him. Let it rain just that wee bit harder, and it would cover any noise he made. He shifted his weight a little, feeling the press of the dirk hard under his hip bone. The pistols lay beside him on the roof, likely useless in the rain. The dirk was his only real weapon at the moment, and one much better suited to surprise than to a frontal attack.
"Send the men back with the boat. We can go by road after..."
They were still talking, low-voiced, but he could tell that the decision had been made. Lilywhite only needed to convince himself that it was a matter of necessity, and that wouldn't take long. They'd send the men away first, though. The magistrate was right to be afraid of witnesses. He blinked water out of his eyes and glanced toward the larger shed where Roger Mack and the Russians were. The sheds were close together, the gaps between the staggered tin roofs no more than 3 or 4 feet. There was one shed between him and the larger one. Well, then. He would take advantage of the men leaving to move across the roofs and trust to luck and the rain to prevent Lilywhite or Anstruther from looking up. Crouch above the door to the shed, and when they came to do the deed, wait just until they'd got the door open, then drop on the magistrate from above and hope to break his neck, or at least disable him at once. Roger Mack could be depended on to rush out and help deal with the sheriff then. It was the best plan he could contrive under the circumstances, and not a bad one, he thought, if he didn't slip and break his own neck, of course. Or a leg. He flexed his left leg, feeling the slight stiffness of the muscles in his calf. It was healed, but there was no denying the slight weakness remaining. He could manage well enough walking, but jumping across rooftops.
"Aye, well, needs must when the devil drives," he muttered.
If it came to smash and he ruined the leg again, he'd better hope the sheriff killed him, because Claire surely would. The thought made him smile, but he couldn't think about her now. Later, when it was finished. His shirt was soaked through, stuck to his shoulders, and the rain was chiming off the tin roofs like a chorus of fairy bells. Squirming cautiously backward, he got his knees under him and rose to a crouch, ready to drop flat again if anyone was looking up. No one was on the dock. There were four men besides Lilywhite and the sheriff. All of them were out in the soft ground to the south of the landing, poking through the waist-high grass in a desultory fashion. He took a deep breath and got his feet slowly under him. As he swiveled round, though, he caught a flicker of movement from the corner of his eye and froze. Holy Christ, there were men coming out of the wood. For an instant he thought it was more of Lilywhite's doing, and then he realised that the men were black. All but one.
"Les cochons," the Russian had said, "pour le Monsieur Wiley."
And here was Monsieur Wiley coming with his slaves to collect his pigs. He lay down on his belly again and squirmed over the wet metal, eeling toward the back of the shed roof. It was open to question, he thought, whether Wiley would be better disposed to help him or to run him through himself. But he did suppose the man had some stake in preserving his rations. The water was cold, but not numbing, and the pull of the tidal current wasn't great yet. Still, the injury to his throat and the searing of the canebrake fire had left him much shorter of breath than he used to be, and Roger found himself obliged to bob to the surface and gasp for air with every three or four strokes.
"Ruby lips are above the water,"
he sang ironically to himself,
"blowing bubbles soft and fine."
He drew in a gulp of air and trod water, listening. He had headed toward the south side of the landing first, but had heard voices above, and so reversed direction. He was just under the north edge of the wharf now, hidden in the deep shadow by the Russian's boat. The smell of pigs was overwhelming, and he could hear muffled thumps and grunts from the hold coming through the wood beside him.
"Christ, they sailed that tiny craft all the way from Russia."
It looked it. The wood was battered and dented. No sound of voices nearby. It was raining hard, shushing into the sound. That would help cover any racket he made.
"Ready, steady, go then."
He took a great lungful of air and launched himself into the rainy light beyond the landing. He swam desperately, trying not to splash, expecting a musket ball between the shoulder blades every moment. He blundered into the weeds, felt the grasp and slash of sawgrass on arm and leg, rolled half over, gasping, salt burning in the cuts, and then was on his hands and knees, crawling through the growth of marsh plants, black needle rushes waving over his head, rain pounding on his back, the water lapping just below his chin. He stopped at last, chest heaving with the need for air, and wondered what in hell to do next. It was good to be out of the shed, but he hadn't a plan for what happened now. Find Jamie, he supposed, if he could, without being caught again. As though the thought had drawn attention to him, he heard the slosh and swish of someone walking slowly through the marsh nearby, searching. He froze, hoping the rain would cover the sound of his breath, loud and rasping in his ears. Closer. Damn, they were coming closer. He fumbled at his belt, but he'd lost the dirk somewhere in his swimming. He got one knee up under his chin, braced himself to spring and run. The grass above him swept suddenly away, and he leapt to his feet just in time to avoid the spear that sliced into the water where he'd lain. The spear quivered in front of him, 6 inches from his face. On the other side of it, a black man gaped at him, eyes saucered in amazement. The Negro closed his mouth, blinked at him, and spoke in tones of deepest accusation.
"You ain't no possum."
"No,"
said Roger mildly.
"I'm not."
He brushed a trembling hand down his chest, assuring himself that his heart was still inside it.
"Sorry."
Philip Wiley looked a great deal different at home, Roger thought, than he did in society. Attired for pig-catching in loose breeks and a farmer's smock, damp with rain, and minus any trace of wig, paint, powder or patches, he was still elegantly slender, but looked quite normal and reasonably competent. He also looked somewhat more intelligent, though his mouth did tend to keep dropping open, and he did insist on breaking into Jamie's account with questions and expostulations.
"Lillywhite? Randall Lillywhite? But what can he—"
"Concentrate, man," Jamie said impatiently. "I'm telling you now, and I'll tell you more later. But he and yon sheriff are like to be carving up your Russians like a set of Christmas hams, and we dinna go and tend to the matter this minute."
Wiley glared at Jamie, then looked suspiciously at Roger, who was standing under the cover of the forest, half naked, soaking wet, and covered with blood-streaked mud.
"He's right,"
Roger croaked, then coughed, cleared his throat, and repeated it more firmly.
"He's right. There's not much time."
Wiley's lips compressed into a thin line, and he exhaled strongly through his nose. He looked round at his slaves as though counting them, a half-dozen men, all carrying stout sticks. One or two had cane knives at their belts. Wiley nodded, making up his mind.
"Come on, then."
Avoiding the telltale crunching of the shell road, they made slow but steady progress through the marsh.
"Why, pigs?"
he heard Jamie ask curiously as he and Wiley forged ahead of the group.
"Not pigs," Wiley replied. "Russian boars, for sport."
He spoke rather proudly, swishing his own stick through the thick grass.
"Everyone says that of all game, the Russian boar is the fiercest and most wily opponent. I propose to release them in the woods on my property and allow them to breed."
"You mean to hunt them?"
Jamie sounded mildly incredulous.
"Have you ever hunted a boar?"
Roger saw Wiley's shoulders stiffen under his damp smock at the question. The rain had slackened, but was still coming down.
"No," he said, "not yet. Have you?"
"Yes,"
Jamie said, but wisely didn't amplify the answer. As they drew near the landing, Roger caught a glimpse of movement beyond. The smaller boat was pulling away.
"They've given up looking for me, or the whiskey, and sent their men away."
Jamie wiped a hand down his face, slicking the rain away.
"What say you, Wiley? There's no time to lose. The Russians are in the main shed on the wharf."
Once decided, Wiley was no ditherer.
"Storm the place," he said shortly.
He waved a hand, beckoning his slaves to follow, and headed for the landing at a trot. The whole party swerved onto the shell road, thundering toward the wharf with a noise like an avalanche.
That ought to give Lillywhite and Anstruther pause in their murdering, Roger thought. They sounded like an approaching army.
Barefoot, Roger kept to the marshy ground and was in consequence slower than the rest. He saw a startled face peer out between the sheds and quickly withdraw. Jamie saw it too and gave one of his wild Highland cries. Wiley jerked, startled, but then joined in, bellowing,
"Get out of it, you bastards!"
Thus encouraged, the Negroes all began shouting and bellowing, waving their sticks with enthusiasm as they charged the landing. It was something of an anticlimax to arrive on the wharf and find no one there, save the captive Russians, who narrowly missed beheading Philip Wiley when he imprudently shoved open the door to their prison without announcing himself. A brief search of the Russian boat and the surrounding marsh turned up no trace of Lillywhite and Anstruther.
Most likely swim for it, one of the negroes said, returning from the search.
He nodded across the channel toward the tangle of the sandbars and fingered his spear.
We go hunt them.
It was the man who had discovered Roger, evidently still eager to try his luck.
They didn't swim, Wiley said shortly.
He gestured at the tiny beach near the landing, an empty stretch of oyster shells.
They've taken my boat, blast them.
He turned away, disgusted, and began to give orders for unloading and penning the Russian boars. Chermodarov and his family had already been taken off to the plantation house, with the girls alternating between amazement at the black slaves and coy looks at Roger, who had retrieved his shirt and shoes, but whose breeches were still plastered to his body. One of the slaves appeared from the shed with an armful of discarded weaponry, recalling Wiley temporarily to the duties of a host.
"I'm obliged to you for your help in preserving my property, sir," he said to Jamie.
He bowed rather stiffly.
"Will you not allow me to offer you and Mr. Mackenzie my hospitality?"
He didn't sound thrilled about it, Roger noted, but still he'd offered.
"I'm obliged to you, sir, for your help in preserving our lives," Jamie said with equal stiffness, returning the bow. "And I thank you, but..."
"We'd be delighted," Roger interrupted. "Thanks."
He gave Wiley a firm handshake, surprising him very much, and grabbed Jamie by the arm, steering him toward the shell road before he could protest. There were times and places to be on your high horse, he supposed, but this wasn't one of them.
"Look, you haven't got to kiss the man's bum," he said in response to Jamie's mutterings as they slogged toward the forest. "Let his butler give us a dry towel and a bit of lunch, and we'll be off while he's still busy with his boars. I've had no breakfast, and neither have you, and if we've got to walk to Edenton, I'm no doing it on an empty belly."
The mention of food seemed to go some way toward restoring Jamie's equanimity, and as they reached the semi-shelter of the wood, a mood of almost giddy cheerfulness had sprung up between them. Roger wondered if this was the sort of way you felt after a battle. The sheer relief of finding yourself alive and unwounded made you want to laugh and arse about, just to prove you still could. By unspoken consent, they left discussion of recent events, and speculation as to the present whereabouts of Stephen Bonnet, for later.
"Russian boars, for Christ's sake," Jamie said, shaking himself like a dog as they paused under the shelter of the wood. "And I doubt the man's ever seen a boar in his life. You think he could manage to kill himself without going to such expense about it?"
"Aye, what do you think it must have cost? More money than we'll see in 10 years, likely, just to haul a lot of pigs. What, 6,000 miles?
He shook his head, staggered at the thought.
"Well, to be fair about it, they're more than only pigs," Jamie said tolerantly. "Did you not see them?"
Roger had, though only briefly. The slaves had been herding one of the animals across the dock as he'd emerged from the shed with his clothes. It was tall and hairy, with long yellow tushies that looked nasty enough. It was emaciated from the long sea voyage, though, its ribs showing and half its bristly pelt rubbed bald. It had obviously not got its land legs yet, staggering and careening drunkenly on its ridiculous small hooves, eyes rolling, grunting in panic as the slaves shouted and poked at it with their poles. Roger felt quite sorry for it.
"Oh, they're big enough, aye," he said, "and I suppose once they've filled out a bit, they'll be something to see. I wonder how they'll like this, though, after Russia."
He waved a hand at the damp, scrubby wood around them. The air was moist with rain, but the trees blocked most of the downfall, leaving it dark and resin-smelling under the low canopy of scrub oak and scraggy pines. Twigs and acorn caps crunched pleasantly under their boots on the sandy earth.
"Well, there are acorns and roots aplenty," Jamie observed, "and the odd negro now and then for a treat. I expect they'll do well enough."
Roger laughed, and Jamie grunted in amusement.
"You think I'm jesting, I? You'll not have hunted boar either, I suppose."
Well, perhaps Mr. Wiley will invite us to come and..."
The back of his head exploded. and everything disappeared. At some point he became aware again, aware mostly of a pain so great that unconsciousness seemed immensely preferable, but aware too of pebbles and leaves pressing into his face and of noises nearby, the clash and thud and grunt of men fighting in earnest. He forced himself toward consciousness and raised his head, though the effort made coloured fireworks go off inside his eyes and made him want very badly to throw up. He braced himself on his folded arms, teeth gritted, and after a moment his vision cleared, though things were still blurred. It took a moment to make out what was happening. They were 10 feet or so beyond the spot where he lay, with bits of tree and brush obscuring the fight. He caught a muttered, "Aye," though, among the panting and grunting, and felt a sharp pang of relief. Jamie was alive, then. He got to his knees, swaying, and stayed there for a moment, his vision winking in and out of blackness. When it steadied, his head had fallen forward and he was staring at the ground. His sword lay a few feet away, half covered with scuffed sand and leaves. One of his pistols was with it, but he didn't bother with that. He couldn't hold it steady, even if the powder was still dry enough to fire. He scrabbled and fumbled, but once he'd got his hand wedged into the basket of the sword's hilt, he felt a little better. He wouldn't drop it now. Something wet was running down his neck. Blood? Rain? It didn't matter. He staggered, clutched a tree with his free hand, blinked away the blackness, took another step. He felt like the boar, unfamiliar ground shifting and treacherous under his feet. He trod on something that rolled and gave way, and he fell, landing hard on one elbow. He turned awkwardly over, hampered by the sword, and found that he had stepped on Anstruther's leg. The sheriff was lying on his back, mouth open, looking surprised. There was a large rip in his neck, and a lot of blood had soaked into the sand around him, rusty and stinking. He recoiled, and the shock of it got him on his feet, with no memory of having stood up. Lillywhite's back was to him, the linen of his shirt wet and sticking to his flesh. He lunged, grunting, then flung back, beat, riposted. Roger shook his head, trying to clear it of the idiotic terms of swordsmanship, then stopped, gasping with pain. Jamie's face was set in a manic half-grin, teeth bared with effort as he followed his opponent's weapon. He'd seen Roger, though.
"Roger!"
he shouted, breathless with the fight.
"Roger! Acharad!"
Lillywhite didn't turn, but flung himself forward, fainting, beating away, lunging back in tears.
"Not stupid," he gasped.
Roger realised dimly that Lillywhite thought Jamie was bluffing, trying to make him turn around. His vision was flickering round the edges again, and he grabbed for a tree, gripping hard to stay upright. The foliage was wet. His grip was slipping.
"Hey,"
he called hoarsely, unable to think of any words. He raised his sword, the tip trembling.
"Hey!"
Lillywhite stepped back and whirled around, eyes wide with shock. Roger lunged blindly with no aim, but with all the power left in his body behind it. The sword went into Lillywhite's eye, and a slithering crunch ran up Roger's arm as metal scraped bone and went through to something softer where it stuck. He tried to let go, but his hand was trapped in the basket hilt. Lillywhite went stiff, and Roger could feel the man's life run straight down the sword, through his hand and up his arm, swift and shocking as an electric current. Panicked, he jerked and twisted, trying to get the sword free. Lillywhite spasmed, went limp, and fell toward him, flopping like a huge dead fish as Roger wrenched and yanked, vainly trying to free himself from the sword. Then Jamie seized him by the wrist and got him loose. Got an arm around him and led him away, stumbling and blind with panic and pain. Held his head and rubbed his back, murmuring nonsense in Gaelic while he puked and heaved. Wiped his face and neck with hands full of wet leaves. Wiped the snot from his nose with the wet sleeve of his shirt.
"You okay?"
Roger mumbled, somewhere in the midst of this.
"Aye, fine," Jamie said, and patted him again. "You're fine, too. All right?"
At length he was on his feet again. His head had gone past the point of pain. It still hurt, but the pain seemed a separate thing from himself, hovering somewhere nearby but not actually touching him. Lily-White lay face up in the leaves. Roger closed his eyes and swallowed. He heard Jamie mutter something under his breath, and then a grunt, a rustling of leaves, and a small thud. When Roger opened his eyes, Lily-White was lying face down, the back of his shirt smeared with sand and acorn hulls.
"Come on."
Jamie got him under the arm, pulled the arm over his shoulder. Roger lifted his free hand, waved it vaguely toward the bodies.
"Them? What should we do with them?" "Leave them for the pigs."
This ends Disc 43. The Fiery Cross, Disc 44.
Roger could walk by himself by the time they left the wood, though he had a tendency to drift to one side or the other, unable to steer quite straight as yet. Wiley's house lay before them, a handsome construction in red brick. They picked their way across the lawn, ignoring the stares of several house servants, who clustered at the upstairs windows, pointing down at them and murmuring to one another.
"Why?"
Roger asked, stopping for a moment to shake some of the leaves from his shirt.
"Did they see?" "No."
Jamie pulled a soggy wad of cloth that had once been a handkerchief from his sleeve and swished it in the ornamental fountain. He used it to mop his face, looked critically at the resultant streaks of filth, and soused it in the fountain again.
"The first I knew was the thud when Anstruther clubbed you. Here, your head's still bleeding. I turned round to see you lying on the ground, and the next instant a sword came at me out of nowhere right across my ribs. Look at that, will you?"
He poked his fingers through a large rent in his shirt, wiggling them.
"I ducked behind a tree and barely got my own blade out in time. But neither of them said a word at all."
Roger pressed the proffered handkerchief gingerly to the back of his head. He sucked air through his teeth with a hiss as the cold water touched the wound.
"Shit. Is it only that my head's cracked, or does that make no sense? Why in Christ's name try so hard to kill us?" "Because they wanted us dead,"
Jamie said logically, turning up his sleeves to wash his hands in the fountain.
"Or someone else does."
The pain had decided to take up residence in Roger's head again. He was feeling sick again.
"Stephen Bonnet. If I were a gambling man, I'd put good odds on it."
Roger closed one eye in order to correct a tendency for there to be two of Jamie.
"You are a gambling man. I've seen you do it." "Well, there you are then."
Jamie ran a hand absently through his matted hair and turned toward the house. Karina and her sisters had appeared at the window and were waving ecstatically.
"What I want very much to know just now is, where is Stephen Bonnet?"
"Wilmington."
Jamie swung round, frowning at him.
"What?"
"Wilmington,"
Roger repeated. He cautiously opened the other eye, but it seemed all right. Only one, Jamie.
"That's what Lily-White said. But I thought he was joking."
Jamie stared at him for a moment.
"I hope to Christ he was," he said.
Chapter 103. Among the Myrtles. Wilmington. By contrast with Fraser's Ridge, Wilmington was a giddy metropolis, and under normal circumstances, the girls and I should have fully enjoyed its delights. Given the absence of Roger and Jamie, and the nature of the errand they were bound upon, though, we were able to find little distraction. Not that we didn't try. We lived through the creeping minutes of nights broken by crying children, and haunted by imaginations worse than nightmare might be. I was sorry that Brianna had seen as much as she had after the battle at Alamance. Vague imaginings based on fear were bad enough. Those based on close acquaintance with the look of ruined flesh, of smashed bone and staring eyes, were a good deal worse.
Rising heavy-eyed amid a crumple of discarded clothes and stale linen, we fed and dressed the children and went out to seek what mental respite might be found during the day in the distractions of horse racing, shopping, or the competing musicales hosted once a week on successive evenings by Mrs. Crawford and Mrs. Dunning, the two most prominent hostesses in town. Mrs. Dunning's evening had taken place the day after Roger and Jamie left. Performances upon the harp, violin, harpsichord, and flute were interspersed with recitations of poetry. At least it was referred to as poetry, and songs both comic and tragic, sung by Mr. Angus McCaskill, the popular and courteous proprietor of the largest ordinary in Wilmington. The tragic songs were actually much funnier than the comic ones, owing to Mr. McCaskill's habit of rolling his eyes up into his head during the more lugubrious passages, as though he had the lyrics written on the inside of his skull. I adopted a suitably solemn expression of appreciation, though, biting the inside of my cheek throughout. Brianna required no such aid to courtesy. She sat staring at all the performances with a countenance of such brooding intensity that it seemed to disconcert a few of the musicians, who eyed her nervously and edged toward the other side of the room, getting the harpsichord safely between her and them. Her attitude had nothing to do with the performance, I knew, but rather with a reliving of the arguments that had preceded the men's departure. These had been prolonged, vigorous, and conducted in low voices as the four of us walked up and down the quay at sunset. Brianna had been impassioned, eloquent, and ferocious. Jamie had been patient, cool, and immovable. I had kept my mouth shut, for once more stubborn than either of them. I could not in conscience side with Bree. I knew what Stephen Bonnet was. I would not side with Jamie. I knew what Stephen Bonnet was. I knew what Jamie was, too, and while the thought of his going to deal with Stephen Bonnet was enough to make me feel as though I were hanging from a fraying rope over a bottomless pit, I did know that there were few men better equipped for such a task. For beyond the question of deadly skill, which he certainly had, there was the question of conscience. Jamie was a Highlander. While the Lord might insist that vengeance was his, no male Highlander of my acquaintance had ever thought it right that the Lord should be left to handle such things without assistance. God had made man for a reason, and high on the list of those reasons was the protection of a family and the defence of its honour, whatever the cost. What Bonnet had done to Brianna was not a crime that Jamie would ever forgive, let alone forget. And beyond simple vengeance, and the continuing threat that Bonnet might pose to Bree or Jemmy, there was the fact that Jamie felt himself responsible, at least in part, for such harm as Bonnet might do in the world, to our family or to others. He had helped Bonnet to escape the gallows once. He would not be at peace until he had amended that mistake, and said so. "Fine," Brianna had hissed at him, fists clenched at her sides. "So you'll be at peace, just fine. And how peaceful do you think Mama and I will be if you or Roger is dead?" "You'd prefer me to be a coward. Or your husband."
"Yes."
"No, you wouldn't," he said with certainty. "You only think so now because you're afraid."
"Of course I'm afraid. So is Mama. Only she won't say so because she thinks you'll go anyway."
"If she does think so, she's right," Jamie said,
giving me a sidelong look with a hint of a smile.
"She's known me a long time, aye?"
I glanced at him, but shook my head, and turned away, sealing my lips and staring out at the masts of the ships anchored in the harbour while the argument raged on. Roger had finally put a stop to it.
"Brianna," he said softly when she paused for breath.
She turned toward him, face anguished, and he touched her shoulder.
"I will not have this man in the same world as my children," he said, still softly, "or my wife. Do we go, then, with your blessing, or without it?"
She had sucked in her breath, bitten her lip, and turned away. I saw the tears brimming in her eyes and the working of her throat as she swallowed them. She said no more. Whatever word of blessing she had given him had been spoken in the night, in the quiet of their bed. I had given Jamie blessing and farewell in that same darkness, still without speaking a word. I couldn't. He would go, no matter what I said. Neither of us slept that night. We lay in each other's arms, silently aware of each breath and shift of body. And when the shutters began to show cracks of grey light, we rose. He to make his preparations, I, because I couldn't lie still and watch him go. As he left, I stood on tiptoe to kiss him and whispered the only important thing. "Come back," I'd said. He'd smiled at me, smoothing a curl behind my ear.
"You ken what I said at Allemans. Well, it's no today either, Sassenach. We'll both be back."
Mrs. Crawford's assembly, held the next evening, boasted the same performers for the most part as had Mrs. Dunning's, but had one novelty. It was there that I smelled myrtle candles for the first time. "What is that lovely scent?" I asked Mrs. Crawford during the interval, sniffing at the candelabra that decorated her harpsichord. The candles were beeswax, but the scent was something both delicate and spicy. Rather like bayberry, but lighter. "Wax myrtle," she replied, gratified. "I don't use them for the candles themselves, though one can, but it does take such a tremendous quantity of the berries. Near 8 pound to get only 1 pound of the wax. Imagine! It took my bond maid a week of picking, and she brought me barely enough as would make a dozen candles. So I rendered the wax, but then I mixed it in with the regular beeswax when I dipped the candles. And I will say I am pleased. It does give such a pleasant aroma, does it not?" She leaned closer to me, lowering her voice to a confidential whisper. "Someone said to me that Mrs. Dunning's home smelled last night as though the cook had scorched the potatoes at supper." And so, on the third day, faced with the alternatives of a day spent cooped up with three small children in our cramped lodgings, or a repeat visit to the much diminished remains of the dead whale, I borrowed several buckets from our landlady, Mrs. Burns, commissioned a picnic basket, and marshalled my troops for a foraging expedition. Brianna and Massali consented to the notion with alacrity, if not enthusiasm. "Anything is better than sitting around worrying," Brianna said. "Anything." "Aye, and anything is better than the stink of filthy clouts and sour milk, too," Massali added. She fanned herself with the book, looking pale. "I could do with a bit of air." I worried a little about Masali's ability to walk so far, given her expanding girth. She was in her seventh month. But she insisted that the exercise would benefit her, and Brianna and I could help to carry Joni. As is usual in cases of travel with small children, our departure was somewhat prolonged. Joni spit up mashed sweet potato down the front of her gown. Jemmy committed a sanitary indiscretion of major proportions, and Germaine disappeared during the confusion occasioned by these mishaps. He was discovered, at the conclusion of a half-hour search involving everyone in the street, behind the public livery stable, happily engaged in throwing horse dung at passing carriages and wagons. Everyone forcibly cleaned, redressed, and, in Germaine's case, threatened with death and dismemberment, we descended the stairs again, to find that the landlord, Mr. Burns, had helpfully dug out an old goat cart with which he kindly presented us. The goat, however, was employed in eating nettles in the next door garden and declined to be caught. After a quarter of an hour's heated pursuit, Brianna declared that she would prefer to pull the cart herself rather than spend any longer playing ring around the rosy with a goat. "Mrs. Fraser! Mrs. Fraser!" We were halfway down the street, the children, buckets and picnic basket in the goat-cart, when Mrs. Burns came hurrying out of the inn after us, a jug of small beer in one hand and an ancient flintlock pistol in the other. "Snakes," she explained, handing me the latter. "My Annie says she saw at least a dozen adders last time she walked that way." "Snakes," I said, accepting the object and its attendant paraphernalia with reluctance. "Quite." Given that adder could mean anything from a water moccasin to the most harmless grass snake, and also given that Annie Burns had a marked talent for melodrama, I wasn't unduly concerned. I thought of dropping the gun into the picnic basket, but a glance at Germaine and Jemmy, pictures of cherubic innocence, decided me of the unwisdom of leaving even an unloaded firearm anywhere near them. I dropped the pistol into my berry bucket instead and put it over my arm. The day was overcast and cool, with a light breeze off the ocean. The air was damp, and I thought there was a good chance of rain before long, but for the moment it was very pleasant out, with the sandy earth packed down sufficiently from earlier rains to make the walking easy. Following Mrs. Crawford's directions, we made our way a mile or so down the beach and found ourselves at the edge of a thick growth of coastal forests, where scanty-needled pines mingled with mangroves and palmetto in a dense, sun-splintered tangle twined with vines. I closed my eyes and breathed in, nostrils flaring at the intoxicating mixture of scents, mudflats and wet sand, pine resins and sea air, the last faint whiffs of dead whale, and what I'd been looking for, the fresh, tangy scent of wax myrtles. "That way," I said, pointing into the tangle of vegetation. The going was too heavy for the cart now, so we left it, allowing the little boys to run wild, chasing tiny crabs and bright birds as we made our way slowly into the scrubby forest. Massali carried Joan, who curled up like a dormouse in her mother's arms, and went to sleep, lulled by the sound of ocean and wind. In spite of the heavy growth, the walking was more pleasant here than on the open beach. The wind-stunted trees were tall enough to give a pleasing sense of secrecy and refuge, and the footing was better, with a thin layer of decaying leaves and needles underfoot. Jemmy grew tired of walking and tugged on my skirt, raising both arms to be picked up. "All right." I hung a berry bucket from one wrist and swung him up with a crackle and pop of vertebrae. He was a very solid little boy. He twined his sandy feet comfortably round my waist and rested his face on my shoulder with a sigh of relief. "All very well for you," I said, gently patting his back. "Who's going to give Granny a ride, hey?"
"Granda," he said, and giggled.
He lifted his head, looking round.
"Where, Granda?"
"Granda's busy," I told him, taking care to keep my voice light and cheerful.
"We'll see Granda and Daddy soon."
"Want Daddy?"
"Yes, so does Mummy," I murmured. "Here, sweetie, see that? See the little berries? We're going to pick some. Won't that be fun?" "No, don't eat them." "Jemmy, I said no. Do not put them in your mouth. They'll make you sick."
We had found a luxuriant patch of wax myrtles, and soon spread out, losing sight of each other amid the bushes as we picked, but calling out every few minutes in order not to lose each other entirely. I had put Jemmy down again, and was idly contemplating whether there might be any use for the berry pulp once the myrtle berries were boiled to render the wax, when I heard the soft crunch of footsteps on the other side of the bush I was picking from.
"Is that you, darling?" I called, thinking it was Brianna. "Perhaps we ought to have our lunch soon. I think it's maybe coming on to rain." "Well, it's a kind invitation, sure," said a male voice, sounding amused. "I thank you, ma'am, but I've made a decent breakfast not long since."
He stepped out from behind the bush, and I stood paralysed, completely unable to speak. My mind, oddly enough, was not paralysed in the slightest. My thoughts were running at the speed of light. "If Stephen Bonnet's here, Jamie and Roger are safe, thank God. Where are the children? Where is Bree? Where's that gun? God damn it!"
"Who's that, Grandmère?"
Germaine appeared from behind a bush with what appeared to be a dead rat dangling from one hand, approached me warily, blue eyes narrowed at the intruder.
"Germaine," I said in a croak, not taking my eyes off Bonnet. "Go find your mother and stay with her. Grandmère, is it?
And who will his mother be, then?"
Bonnet glanced from me to Germaine and back, interested. He tilted back the hat he wore and scratched at the side of his jaw.
"Never mind that," I said as firmly as I could. "Germaine, go!"
I stole a look downward, but the pistol was not in my bucket. There were 6 buckets, and we had left 3 on the goat cart. Undoubtedly, the gun was in one of those, worse luck.
Oh, don't be going just yet, young sir.
Bonnet made a move toward Germaine, but the little boy